Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, known as Apostolic Sabbatarian Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is July 10, 2016, or it's 8-7, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled A Sweet By and By. Bless of all that is said and day, and by faith we can see it afar. For the Father waits over the way to prepare us a dwelling place there. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. We shall sing on that beautiful shore melodious songs of the blood, and our spirits shall sorrow no more. Not a sign for the blessing of love. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on the beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on the beautiful shore. Your bountiful Father above, we will offer a tribute of praise for the glorious gift of His love, the blessing that hallow our day. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. The Two Babylons, Part 3, we're going to continue our series now. We're on page number 8 of our book, The Two Babylons, by Alexander Hislop. Okay, we'll do just a little review from our last study. It says, the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Then it has a footnote here, that which I have rendered and is in the authorized version are, but there is no reason for such a rendering, for the word in the original is the very same as that which connects the previous clause. In my heart, it will be seen by and by what cognate reason there was in point of fact for the profoundest secrecy in the matter. See chapter 2. Alright, it says that the mystery of iniquity doth already work. That's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 verse 7. And I read that in my last study, but I want to go and pull up 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 again. And show you in our day, when this 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 verse 7 met its fulfillment in our day. This is what's so interesting, having lived in the past through these times, and having gone through these here steps of the movement. Notice I said the movement. The third step of the genuine movement, Gilead Center, is where we met the fulfillment of this here 2 Thessalonians 2:11. But I'm going to start with the very first verse again and read the whole thing. Let's see if I can get to my Thessalonians. Now we beseech you, brethren, about the coming of Yeshua Messiah, our Savior, and by our gathering together unto him, that we be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that the day of Yeshua is at hand. Now here Paul is talking 2,000 years ago. He's talking to the Thessalonian Gentiles. Now he's talking to the Gentiles here. And they're new converts. And they've been taught for the first time about this man Yeshua that had just gone back to heaven about 3 years earlier. And they were being taught firsthand about his ministry and so forth, and how he actually indeed died for our sins according to the scriptures. And that's in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 1 to 3. But anyway, he says that in the 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, he says to these Gentile Thessalonians, let no man deceive you by any means. I mean, he's talking about no man. He's talking about don't let any of these Jews, Pharisees, and these Sadducees that are milling around, that don't have anything else to do but just go from town to town and from city and from house to house, and anybody that they can get in and talk to, that let them come in, they'll go in and they'll teach you false doctrine. They'll tell you lies. And so it says, so let no man deceive you. In other words, you have a man come knocking on your door. You don't know who he is. Have him to qualify himself. And if he can't qualify himself, don't receive him. But anyway, he goes on and tells him, he says, let no man deceive you by any means. By any means. You know, no matter what kind of means he tries to deceive you by, not by any means. For that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Now he's talking about the soon coming of Yeshua. He said that day is not going to come. Shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Now, here Brother W. Johnson, in 2002, as we were approaching the Passover of that year, he was saying, now, folks, I got good news for you. This is the antitypical year. So the Passover is happening exactly on the same day of the week as it did back to 2,000 years ago. And it's time for Jesus, he called him Jesus, so I'll repeat it, to come. It's time for him to come now. And he's going to visit us at our Passover. All right. Now, this is good news for all of us. And I believed him. I literally believed him. But you know what? I don't think anybody outside my wife believed him, including Alan DeLong. I think they just brushed it off as just some old whistling in the wind for Brother Johnson. And, The way they conduct themselves at Passover, I'm sure that's exactly the way they received that information, brother. It was just another one of them things that he'd come up with, just out of clear blue, and without no provocation for that. It's just out of clear blue. Here he is. Well, this is the year, folks. As if he had some inside pertinent information that was ensure to him that this was the year. So it says now, but Paul is warning these disciples. He said, now, we are brethren. In Ephesians 2, he told them, he said, we're brethren. But he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. So now, this is after the cross, And this man of sin was Judas Iscariot 3 years earlier. So Paul, by being taught what had happened 3.5 years earlier, when Yahshua was bringing the ministry, his ministry to a close here on earth, Paul was using that as a type. He was using it as a type. He was showing the Gentiles where Yahshua had to deal with a son of perdition, a man of sin, among his 12 disciples that he had chosen. And it was one of those that Yahshua had approved of, and that was Judas Iscariot. But Yahshua approved of Judas Iscariot for the benefit of the other 11 disciples, because they're the ones that actually chose Judas to be the number 12. So Yahshua approved of it, and so he knew Judas' heart. He knew that he was going to betray him, but he let it run its course. And so Paul is saying, well, what happened in Yahshua's day, that Yahshua is not going to come, except the first come of fallen away, and the man of sin, the son of perdition, be revealed. Knowing full well that Yahshua has already come and gone the first time. So now Paul is telling these Thessalonian Gentiles, those of you that are looking for him to come a second time, here's what you're to expect. So he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. So Paul was warning them that in the future, at the second coming of Yahshua, he's not going to come except that a man of sin shall be revealed again, once again, in the church. And he's not going to come until that there comes a falling away in the church again, and that there be another man of sin revealed like Judas Iscariot was. So that's going to be your sign. And so when Yahshua was up on the mount there before his ascension, that was in Matthew 24, the disciples, just they really were in consternation over wanting to have a sign from Yahshua, what would be the sign of his coming when he goes away and comes back again. What would be the sign of your coming? What are we to look for? And what does he tell the disciples, Yahshua himself? He said unto them, Matthew 24, verse 2, and Yahshua said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And all the time they thought Yahshua was there in the person to restore Jerusalem, not to tear it down. Oh my, they weren't expecting that at all. And then it says in verse 3, and as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And Yahshua answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, see that you be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. Okay. All these are the beginning of sorrow. Alright, now what did he say there? And in verse 4 again, and Yahshua answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. Now he's telling the disciples up front. But he said, when I come back a second time, here's what's going to happen. There's going to be many coming in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and shall deceive many. And lo and behold, last but not least, the last angel of the seventh candlestick, 2002, Brother Johnson, was one of those very ones bringing up the tail end, saying, I am the Messiah. This is so hard to fathom that when you meet him, you first meeting as an ordained prophet, that is specially picked by heaven and earth, and by heaven and Yahshua, to be his number one servant here on earth. And lo and behold, it turns out to be a false prophet and claiming to be the Messiah himself. And now you see why Yahshua said to the disciples, "Take heed that no man deceive you." He didn't say, "Take heed that no prophet deceive you." Because if there's a true prophet around, you're going to know him, all right. But you won't accept him as a true prophet if you hadn't accepted the truth from me to begin with. So it don't make no difference if he does tell me my name and he is a true prophet. You're not going to receive him unless you have already received me. Now, he says to them, take heed that no man deceive. Then he says to these Thessalonian Gentiles, he said, let no man deceive you by any man. He's telling them the same thing he told the disciples. So this is Paul telling, quoting Yahshua here from Matthew. So what's the first admonition that is given to the people that come to hear the truth for the first time even? Take heed that no man deceive you. Many's going to come in my name claiming to be the Messiah even. False prophets. Alright. So now, it says here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Who opposes and exalteth himself above all that is called Yahweh, or that is worshipped, so that he is a Yahweh citizen in the temple of Yahweh, showing himself that he is Yahweh. Now, what did I tell you before about this, my last sermon? That when they go as far as to lose a complete inspiration on anything, and they start making false claims at them. Well, I guess, really, I can't figure out who I am. I must be the Messiah. I guess that's who I really am. So here we had, before Verda Johnson, we had Ben Roden claiming to be David, antithetical David. He claiming to be the man on the white horse there in Revelation 4, that first horse of the apocalypse. He claimed to be that man on the white horse, which was the top was Adam. But then he ended up claiming to be the Messiah, and then he had a son named Buck Roden, and Buck Roden said, "I am the Messiah." And then Brother Johnson succeeds Buck Roden and Ben Roden, and Brother Johnson said, "I know I'm the Messiah." So we had three people right there in a row claiming to be the Messiah that was in charge of the candlestick of the Office of Inspiration, the sanctuary service. Especially Brother Johnson, the sanctuary service fully restored. And he still ended up being the Messiah. But he claimed about 15 other different titles, about 15 or 20 other different titles, I suppose, for the last 33 years, and none of them worked out, and so on. He just make a bizarre one. He just picked one up, and so he did. So it says here, that this man that does this man of sin, that falls away. Now he does this after he falls away. After he's been exposed and he falls away, this is when he makes himself the Messiah. And then what does he do? He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called of the Yahweh, or that is worshipped, so that he as the Supreme Yahweh sitteth in the temple of Yahweh, showing himself that he is Yahweh, kind of like King Herod did. King Herod says, "Well, hey, the people want to have the impression and feel like that I am a, well, I am a God. Well, I don't think I'll do anything to change your mind on that. I kind of like that idea of being looked upon as a God. Wow, this is quite a thing. And lo and behold, it cost him his life right then and there. So it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, 5, remember ye not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things? He said, you haven't forgotten, Paul was telling these Thessalonians. He said, you haven't forgotten when I was yet with you, I told you these things? And now you know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. Who might be revealed in his time? Yeshua. Now you know what withholdeth that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity, or is this talking about Yeshua? Let's see here. And now you know what withholdeth that he might be revealed in his time. Who is this that might be revealed in his time? Could this be the, also the man of sin, the son of perdition? For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth, he will let it until he be taken out of the way. So this is talking about the man of sin, the son of perdition, that is working with the mystery of iniquity in disguise. And then shall that wicked be revealed. That's the end again, and verse 8. And then shall that wicked person be revealed, whom the Yahshua shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan. So this man of sin, son of perdition, Yahshua is, he comes after the working of Satan. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying work. So it's talking about the man of sin here in the last days. He comes after the working of Satan. All right. We have a man of sin on the scene today, and that's Barack Obama. We have this man of sin on the scene today. He's just about to close out 8 years of presidency of this United States and the world. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying money. So now this is talking about Barack Obama here now. Because when it says even him, even means in addition to or also. Also there is someone else that comes after the working of Satan. And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. So now this is talking about in and out of the church, those that son of perdition that was put at the helm of the church, sanctuary, and then he fell away and was revealed. So now this is what he's talking about right here. Even him whose coming is after working of Satan with all power and signs and lying and murder, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not a love of the truth. But it says him is a singular pronoun up here in verse 9, but then it has a plural pronoun down here in verse 10. They, because they. That's a plural pronoun, meaning more than one. So it means that men of sin, these antichrists, these here deceivers, there's more than one. For it says so right there in Matthew 24. Because it says, take heed that no man deceive you. Verse 5. For many shall come in my name, but this is that they. Many is going to come and say, saying, I am the Messiah. So this is that they in verse 10, 2 Thessalonians 2. And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. They could have avoided all of this. All these here ones coming in a false name, saying, I am the Messiah, they could have avoided all that if they just had received the love of the truth when they were born again for the first time, or at least they thought they were born again, and they were made a covenant that they would walk in all the light and accepted all the truth that was shined upon their pathway, and so therefore they were considered in the way of the truth. But because they had not a love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, Elohim shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. But we are bound to give thanks always to Elohim for you, brethren, beloved of the Elohim, because Elohim hath from the beginning chosen you unto salvation through the sanctification of the Spirit and the belief of the truth. So all the Gentiles then had to do to be saved was to believe. Just believe in the truth that's been taught them, accept it, and be willing to walk in the light of the sanctuary from that point on, and in the name of Yahshua and the blood of the Yahshua. So he says, because Elohim has from the beginning chosen you unto salvation through the sanctification of the Spirit and belief of the truth. Okay, so now he said, he has from the beginning. When is the beginning? Well, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 tells us about this beginning of this earth 6,000 years ago. It says, in the beginning, Yahweh created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Okay. So now, when the earth was even without form and void, you had a beginning. In the beginning, when the earth was without form and void, he has chosen you from the beginning, you said, right here. All right, now, verse 14 in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Whereunto he called you by our gospel for the obtaining of the glory of our Savior Yahshua the Messiah. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold onto the traditions which you have been taught. Now, what does Paul mean by this, hold on to the tradition? Because in another place it says you're not to follow the traditions of man. Well, this is true. The uninspired man, you're not to follow his tradition. But now Moses would be a safe one to follow. Now, he established the traditions and customs of the sanctuary system by law. And so that makes it right. But Paul is talking to the Gentile Thessalonians here, is that, therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold onto the traditions that we've taught you of the sanctuary service of the law of Moses and how it applies to you in the new and living way, Hebrews 10:20, through the blood of Yahshua and by the spirit of, by the law of the spirit of life in Yahshua, Romans 8, verse 2. So it says, and hold onto the traditions you have been taught, whether by the word or by our epistle. And our Savior Yahshua the Messiah, himself and Elohim, even our Father, which hath loved us and hath given us everlasting consolation and good hope through the grace, okay, comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work. So this is pretty awesome, folks. You know, I've never heard the scriptures ever preached in all my life by anyone. Never. Not even B.T. Hartsock or Ellen G. White. Because they didn't have the in-depth understanding of these scriptures. They could only give you what was understandable in their day. And they did that now. And faithfully and fully. Ellen G. White, and all the servants, the true servants that was called to deliver a message, they gave all the light that they had on. They had all the understanding of it. But nothing like we have today. Nothing like we have. And so I beseech each and every one of you that you lay a hold fast of the hope that's within you and hold on to that and let no man deceive you by any means. And know for a certainty that there's got to come a falling away and the man of sin, the son of perdition, revealed. So now where does that apply today then? That applies to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. For she is going to be exposed to the world for what she really is. The General Conference President is going to be exposed for being as the number one man of sin, an antichrist to the Adventist Church. And all of his officers are under him is going to be exposed as followers of the Antichrist in our days, sons of perdition. And then that would constitute a falling away, and then the 144,000 coming forth and being revealed and brightly shining as diamonds in the sky, like stars that light up at night. All of a sudden they're going to shine forth in all their brilliancy, the 144,000. And then the world will know the truth of the matter. So they will know that something mighty has taken place in the earth, and that is something mightier than they can comprehend, and there was some unseen power, unknown power and unseen force. So, having said all that, let's go ahead now with our reading of the two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. And I'm on page 8, and I'm going to now leave you 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I've read the whole chapter to you. And we're going to continue now. It says, that system of iniquity, which then began, it was divinely foretold, was to issue in a portentous apostasy. Now, where did this mystery of iniquity first start? It started in heaven with Lucifer. It started the covering cherub. It started with him when he coveted in his heart secretly that he wanted to be like the Most High. Even then, that in the due time would be awfully revealed, and would continue until it should be destroyed. Or continue until it should be destroyed. By the breath of the Yahshua's mouth, and consumed by the brightness of his coming. That's in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. But at its first introduction into the Seventh-day Adventist Church, of course, this book was written back in 1858, and the Adventist Church was definitely on the scene since 1844, but had been on the scene for 14 years when this book was written. But this man, Hislop, was not an Adventist. He was a Presbyterian. Okay. For it wrought mysteriously under the fair but false pretenses, leading men away from the simplicity of the truth as it is in the Yahshua. And it did so secretly for the very same reason that idolatry was secretly introduced in the ancient mysteries of the Babylon. Okay, so now the ancient mysteries of Babylon, you had to have idolatry being secretly introduced into the ancient mysteries of the Babylon. Isn't this strange? Idolatry had to be secretly introduced to a confused, evil system called Babylon. Even that, it had to be snuck in. Okay. So the plan of salvation and true worship being practiced at all times would expose anything that would be a counterfeit or appear to be false in any way as false worship. And we had our example of that in the Garden of Eden. at the Garden Gate, I mean, after sin, with Cain and Abel. We had that example. Right there, blaring example right before the eyes of the whole world, even today. Stands out very bold how Cain had tried to introduce and force false worship upon the Adams family. Okay, and it did so secretly for the very same reason that idolatry was secretly introduced into the ancient mysteries of Babylon. Then it was secretly introduced into then the Catholic, the pagan Rome, whenever they took over the Christian in the first century. Then it was introduced. The mysteries of Babylon then was brought forward from the ancient times, from Nimrod and Semiramis, and brought forth and then secretly introduced into the pagan rituals that the Roman Church. It wasn't called the papacy in that fourth piece, the nondescript piece that Daniel saw. It was called pagan Rome, period. Pagan Rome did not become identified as ecclesiastical Rome until after certain people come along and took their seats as popes, and like Constantine did in 313, and how they started introducing these mysteries of idolatry into the Catholics, into pagan Rome, because pagan Rome had accepted the teachings of the apostles. And they were enforcing the Sabbath day, and they were enforcing the feast days, Passover, Pentecost, and Atonement. They were abiding by all of that. Until someone come along with the mysteries of Babylon. And who was that? We first have a recording that we know of Constantine, the first pope. We wouldn't call that at the time, but nevertheless, that's where they ended up being. For it says it was not safe, it was not prudent to do otherwise. For the zeal of the true church, though destitute of the civil power, would have aroused itself to put the false system and all its abettors beyond the pale of Christianity if they had appeared openly and all at once in all of this grossness. So today, that just started out pure and simple in 1844. They were undefiled. They were not defiled with women. Because the women that brought them their message represented the Millerite movement, and of all those Protestant churches coming out of the Dark Ages, was represented by those women of Babylon. Because they wouldn't come on with the Sabbath truth and join the Sabbath of Seventh-day Adventist, they were called the fallen away women of Babylon. Okay, so it says that if it had appeared open and all at once and all of its grossness, then this would have arrested its progress. Therefore, it was brought in secretly, and by little and little, one corruption being introduced after another, as apostasy proceeded, the backsliding church became prepared to tolerate it, till it had reached the gigantic heights we now see. When in almost every particular the system of the papacy is the very antipodes of the system of the primitive church, of the gradual introduction of all that is now most characteristic of Rome through the working of the mysteries of iniquity, we have very striking evidence preserved even by Rome itself in the inscription copied from the Roman catacombs. These catacombs are the extensive excavations underground in the neighborhood of Rome, in which the Christians, in the times of the persecution during the first three centuries, celebrated their worship and also buried their dead. On some of the tombstones, there are inscriptions still to be found, which are directly in the teeth of the now well-known principles and practices of Rome. See, that was never revealed by Adventists about these catacombs underneath Rome. This is where the Christians hid out for the first 3 centuries. Take only one example. What, for instance, at this day is the more distinguishing mark of the papacy than the enforced celibacy of the clergy? Yet, from these inscriptions, we have most decisive evidence that even in Rome, there was a time when no such system of the clerical celibacy was known. Witness the following found on the different tombs. Unto Basilus, the presbyter, and Philistata, his wife, they made this for themselves. Petronia, Tronia, a priest's wife, the type of modesty, in this place I lay my bones. Spare your tears, dear husband and daughter, and believe that it is forbidden to weep for one who lives in the Yahweh. So if a person dies in the truth and he has his name retained on the Lamb's Book of Life to accompany that resurrection, you're not to weep for him. You should rejoice. I lost a twin brother at the age of 22 years old. In the hospital, I was at his bedside when he passed away. And a few weeks earlier, had got down on his knees and repented of all of his sins. He wanted to be saved. He knew he was going to pass away. And he wanted to be saved. And so after he did that, there was a peace come over my mother and me. We were at the hospital. A peace came over us that transcended everything else that was going on around us. And so when my twin brother passed away, I didn't weep for him. I didn't shed one tear. Matter of fact, I helped the nurses clean him up and prepare him for his funeral. And I was so glad to see him laying there in peace, finally at last, knowing that he's going to come forth in the resurrection. That just gave me a peace beyond understanding. I know what I'm talking about. I've been there and done that. A prayer here and there for the dead. May Elohim refresh thy spirit, proves that even then the mystery of iniquity had begun to work. But inscriptions such as the above equally show that it had been slowly and cautiously working, that up to the period unto which they refer, the Roman Church had not proceeded the length it has done now, and absolutely forbidding its priests to marry. Craftily and gradually did Rome lay the foundation of the system of the priestcraft, on which it was afterwards to rear so vast a superstructure as at its commencement. Mystery was stamped upon its system, but this feature of the mystery has adhered to it throughout its whole course. When it had once succeeded in dimming the light of the gospel, obscuring the fullness of and freeness of the grace of Elohim, and drawing away the souls of men from direct and immediate dealings with the one grand prophet and high priest of our profession, a mysterious power was attributed to the clergy, which gave them dominion over the faith of the people, a dominion directly disclaimed by the apostolic men, 2 Corinthians 1:24, but which in the connection with the confessional has become at least as absolute and complete as was ever possessed by the Babylonian priests over those and initiated in the ancient mysteries. The clerical power of the Roman priesthood culminated in the erection of the confessional. That confessional was itself borrowed from Babylon. You see there how these mysteries, how they crept into the Catholic Church for the confession, required of the votaries of Rome, is entirely different from the confession prescribed in the Word of Yahweh. For the dictate of the Scripture in regard unto the confession is, confess your faults one to another, James 5:16, which implies that the priest should confess to the people as well as the people to the priest. They're to confess their fault. If either should sin against the other. Now that's the only way you should confess your fault to anybody. If you have sinned against that person. For it says this could never have served any purpose of the spiritual despotism. And therefore Rome, leaving the word of the Elohim, has had recourse unto the Babylonian system. In that system, secret confession to the priest, according unto a prescribed form, was required of all who were admitted to the mystery. Until such confession had been made, no complete initiation could take place. Thus, does Salverti refer to this confession as observed in the Greeks, and the rites that can be clearly traced unto a Babylonian origin. All the Greeks from Delphi, the Thermopyle, were initiated in the mysteries of the temple of Delphi. That silence in regard unto everything they were commanded to keep secret was secured both by the fear of the penalties threatened unto a purge of revelation and by the general confession exacted of the aspirants after initiation, or confession which caused them greater dread of the indiscretion of the priest, then gave him reason to dread their indiscretion. This confession is also referred to by the potter in his Greek Antiquities, though it has been generally overlooked. In his account of the Eleusinian mysteries, after describing the preliminary ceremonies and instructions before the admission of the candidates for initiation into the immediate presence of the divinity, he thus proceeds. Then the priest that initiated them called how often proposed a certain question as whether they were fasting, and to which they return answers in a set form. The etc. here might not strike the casual reader, but it is a pregnant et cetera. It's a pregnant et cetera, and contains a great deal. It means, are you free from every violation of chastity, and that not merely in the sense of moral impurity, but in that factitious sense of chastity which paganism always cherishes. Are you free from the guilt of murder? For no one guilty of slaughter, even accidentally, could be admitted till he was purged from the blood, and that there were certain priests called Koes, K-O-E-S, who heard confessions and in such cases and purged the guilt away. The strictness of the inquiries in the pagan confessional is evidently implied in the certain licentious poems of the Propertius, P-R-O-P-E-R-T-I-U-S, Tabulus, and Zuvino. Wilkerson, in his chapter on the private fast and penance, which he says were strictly enforced in connection with the certain regulations at the fixed period, has several classical quotations which clearly prove whence popery derived the kind of question which have stamped that character of the obscenity on its confessional as exhibited in the notorious pages of the Peter Dens. For the penitence under which this auricular confession was required was that the solemnities under which the initiated were to be admitted were so high, so heavenly, so holy, that no man with the guilt lying on his conscience and sin unpurged could lawfully be admitted unto them. For the safety, therefore, of those who were to be initiated, it was held to be indispensable that the officiating priest should thoroughly probe their consciences, lest coming without due purgation from the previous guilt contracted, the wrath of the gods should be provoked against the profane intruders. This was the pretense, but when we know the essentially unholy nature both of the gods and their worship, who can fail to see that this was nothing more than a pretense, that the grand object in requiring this candidate for initiation to make confession to the priest of all of their secret faults and shortcomings and sins was just to put them entirely in the power of those unto whom the inmost feelings of their souls and their most important secrets were confided. Now, exactly in the same way, and for this very same purpose, as Rome erected the confessional, instead of the requiring priest and people alike, as the Scriptures does, to confess their faults one to another, when either have offended the other, it commands all on pain of perdition to confess to the priest, whether they have transgressed against him or no, while the priest is under no obligation to confess to the people at all. Without such confession in the Church of the Rome, there can be no admission to the sacrament, any more than in the days of paganism, there could be admission without confession to the benefit of the mysteries. Now this confession is made by every individual in secrecy and in solitude to the priest sitting in the name and clothed with the authority of God, okay, invested with the power to examine the conscience, to judge the life, to absolve or to condemn according unto his mere arbitrary will and pleasure. This is the grand pivot on which the whole mystery of iniquity as embodied in the papacy is made to turn. And wherever it is submitted to admirably, does it serve the design of binding men in the abject subjection to the priesthood. In the conformity with the principle out of which the confessional grew, the church that is the clergy claimed to be the sole depositories of the true faith of the Christianity. As the Chaldean priests were believed alone to possess the key to the understanding of the mythology of Babylon, a key handed down to them from the primeval antiquity, so the priests of Rome set up to be the sole interpreters of the scripture. They only had the true tradition transmitted from age to age, without which it was impossible to arrive at its true meaning. They therefore require implicit faith in their dogma. All men were bound to believe as the church believed, while the church in this way could shape its faith as it pleased, as possessing supreme authority also over the faith. They could let out little or much, as they judged most expedient, and reserve in teaching the great truths of the religion was as essential for a principle in the system of the Babylon as it is in the Romanism or the Tractarianism of this day. For it was this priestly plan for the dominion over the faith of the man that imprisoned the truth in the unrighteousness in the ancient world, so that darkness covered the earth and gross darkness the people. It was the very same claim in the hands of the Roman priests that ushered in the Dark Ages. when through many a dreary century the gospel was unknown and the Bible a sealed book unto millions who bore the name of Yahshua. In every respect, then we see how justly Rome bears on its forehead the name Mystery Babylon the Great. So that ends chapter 1. Would you believe we actually got through chapter 1? And we're getting close to the end of our study. Got a couple minutes here. So let's just review what we read in chapter 1 a little bit and see what we have got received new. We're learning about how these mysteries of Babylon, they had to be secretly interwoven into pagan Rome this side of the cross. So they had to make their way through that period of the transition of the two great economies that took place at the cross. They had to make had to weave their way also through all of that. The old passing away at the death of Yahshua and the new coming into being. And so Mystery Babylon looked like she was at her end at the cross. But lo and behold, she secretly crept into the apostolic movement, and then she brought her side of it, pagan Rome, to come and join the apostolic movement and to make claims that they believed that the apostles had the truth and they had the true form of worship, and that they needed that true form of worship to go with their form of worship and their idolatry that they were going to add and connect up with the true form of worship. And that's what they ended up doing. That's what got Israel in trouble all through the years, was they would go off and join their heathen friends that they wouldn't purge out of the land, that they'd made friends with and live side by side as neighbors. And then they would go and they'd be enticed away to go and take their true form of worship, Judah, and go and worship with those that had the Baal worship and try to mix the two together. Solomon tried to do that when he set up the great kingdom of David. He tried that with 1,000 different wives. So he had 1,000 different children from 1,000 different wives. And he thought, well, we've got to mix it all together. Well, he did. And look where we're at today. This brings the close of our study. This hour. Contact us at the 11th hour. Call us number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close now for the song. Are you ready for Yahshua to come? The theme of the Bible is Yahshua and how he died to save men. The plan of salvation assures us he's coming back again. Are you ready for Yahshua to come? Are you faithful in all that you do? Have you fought a good fight? Have you stood for the right? Have others seen Yahshua in you? And don't cling to the world and its treasure. This earth will soon pass away. Oh, give him your love without measure. He's calling you today. Are you ready to stand in your place? Are you ready to look in his face? Can you look up and say, this is my King? Are you ready for Yahshua to come?